Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Buddhist Studies on the New Books Network podcast. I'm your host for today, Trevor McManus, and I'm here with Mark Nathan, author of From the Mountains to the Cities, A History of Buddhist Propagation in Modern Korea, published by University of Hawaii Press in 2018 as part of its Contemporary Buddhism series. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thanks, Trevor.
So I thought we'd start our interview today by having you introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about how you became interested in the field of Buddhist studies in general, where you studied, and perhaps who some of your mentors were.
Okay, I'll try to keep it brief because it can be a rather long and winding story. But so my educational background is, in some sense, transcontinental. Started on the East Coast at Rutgers University. That's where I first became interested in Buddhism from taking a class on Buddhist philosophy as an undergraduate. But it was mostly a personal interest at first. But my interest in Asia and in Buddhism led me to Korea after graduation. This was before many people went there to teach English. In 1991, but I spent a year there and came back and did my master's degree at the University of Chicago in religious studies, and wasn't intending to study Korean Buddhism or really Buddhism at all. I was interested in something else, but decided while I was there that I wanted to focus on studying Korean Buddhism, partly because I discovered that very few people had actually been working on this. I felt that it had been overlooked in comparison with Chinese and Japanese Buddhism. And I knew that if I wanted to go on and do my PhD and to pursue this line, that I would need to go back to Korea to study the language, the culture. So I returned to Korea and spent the rest of the 90s there before coming back to the States and starting my PhD program at UCLA under the direction of Robert Buswell, who was probably the most important formative influence in my pursuit of this field. So that's a sort of brief background to how I got into this.
Thank you. It seems like a lot of our hosts here were influenced by Buswell, and I'm sure that we'll have more to come who were influenced by Buswell.
I think so.
So can we talk specifically about the genesis of the book itself and how that unraveled and how the project started?
Sure. Well, it started back when I was in graduate school. I had not known initially which period of Korean Buddhism that I wanted to concentrate on. As you may know, Professor Buswell, his area of expertise is pre-modern, particularly Goryeo Dynasty Buddhism. But I sort of gravitated more toward the modern period. And in learning about kind of early 20th century developments within Korean Buddhism, I kept coming across this term, which in Korean is pogyo, and that's the word that I translate as propagation. I just kept finding it in all of these reform proposals I was reading and elsewhere. I certainly wasn't the first one to call attention to its importance. One of my predecessors, another student of Buswell's, Porty Park, had talked about this in her study of Buddhist reform movements in Korea. But I became just sort of intensely interested in what this meant, what the significance of it was, what role that it had played in the development of modern Korean Buddhism. And so that's essentially what I wrote my dissertation on, and decided to develop that further into the book that we're talking about today.
Great. I think our listeners will enjoy what more is to come in our discussion regarding that. So this book spans a pretty large span of time. Can you tell us a little bit about the chronology and the organization of the book in general?
Sure. Yeah, it does. It does cover a rather long period of time, and it's I can contrast it a little bit with the approach that I took in the dissertation work that I did, because there I sort of divided this topic up into different components, one of them being geography, the sort of geography of propagation or pogyo. Another was the legal aspects, which we'll get into and talk a little bit about. And the last was media, so media and propagation. But for the book, I decided to, instead of organizing it sort of thematically or breaking propagation into its sort of different components and then tracing those components throughout the 20th century, decided to take a chronological approach. So the book begins essentially in the late 19th century, the last, say, 25 years of the 19th century, and goes through the 20th century and into the early 21st century. Partly I was cognizant of the fact that we really did not have any books out there that traced the history of modern Korean Buddhism. And so I thought that would be a nice addition to the field, to have folks who were not familiar with that history be able to sit down and read about it through the lens, of course, of this strategy for reform known as pogyo or propagation. So the chapters are essentially divided up into roughly 35-year chunks, I'd say. And then I look at them, so late 19th century up until the start of the Japanese colonial period in 1910. And then after that, we look at the Japanese colonial period, which was itself about 35 years. And then the 35 years after liberation from Japanese rule up until about 1980. And then the last section looks at those last couple decades of the 20th century and the start of the 21st century.
Well, that must have been a fairly massive undertaking. Just out of curiosity, what were some of the methods that you used when doing your dissertation and writing this book?
Well, I had spent some time in Korea after starting my graduate work in 2003. I was there. I'd also gone for the World Cup in 2002, and had really been witnessing both the efforts of various Christian groups to use that event as a platform for trying to proselytize and evangelize, but also looking at the corresponding efforts by the Buddhist community to introduce foreign audiences to Korean Buddhism through the Temple Stay program. So I did, in the dissertation, had considered trying to incorporate more sort of contemporary field work into my study of the topic. But for the most part, I stuck to analysis of historical texts and going through many of the Buddhist journals and magazines that had been produced, some of the propagation manuals over the course of the 20th century that were produced. But I do draw a little bit on the some of the more contemporary aspects and some of the time that I spent in Korea, even going back into the mid-90s when I was there and had taken part in a retreat at Songgwangsa, a famous temple there, which was using the mountain monastery spaces for inviting lay people from the cities to come and spend a week trying to learn how to meditate and follow the routines of the monastery. So it's a kind of a mixture of different methods that I used.
Yeah, that's apparent in the writing, and I think our readers will see the extent to which you considered historical documents. It's very thoroughly researched, and I really enjoyed that aspect of the work. Now, you've mentioned Pogyo. You've put that term out there, which is a really critical term for our discussion about this book, which you translate as propagation. Can you tell us a little bit in general about the meaning of Pogyo and perhaps, generally speaking, propagation and proselytization of Buddhism in general, just to give our audience an idea of where we're going?
Sure. I try to stick to using the term Pogyo itself as much as possible, but I had to grapple in this book with how to translate that term. I prior to undertaking this project, had encountered a lot of different ways that people dealt with it and often would talk about it as sort of Buddhist proselytizing. And I wasn't too comfortable with that because I felt like, we can talk about this a little later, but the issue of conversion for me was a factor in that. So Pogyo itself is a term that actually had been, it is a canonical term. You can find its use in the Chinese language Buddhist canon. It's not used that often, and it isn't used in the way that it was subsequently deployed in the modern period. But Japanese Buddhists were among the first, and for in Japanese, the term is known as Fukyo. But it's essentially spreading. It's akin to words that mean to kind of spread something out. And so the sense in which this activity is designed to spread the Buddhist teachings, that's really how it's used. And so I thought propagation is really the best translation for that term Pogyo, but I'll probably use in our discussion Pogyo as much as I use propagation.
I see. So we'll begin talking about the history of Pogyo in modern Korea. And I thought it would be an appropriate starting point to talk about the status of the Korean Buddhist community in the late 19th century in the Joseon era. In terms of geography and political status, as well as social status. And I think this relates to what you discuss in the book as the mountain trope. Can you tell us a little bit about that, please?
Sure. This is a condition, despite the fact that Buddhism has a very long history, 1,500-year history on the Korean Peninsula. By the time we get to the late 19th century, the fortunes of Buddhist institutions organizations and individuals had really suffered a kind of loss of power and prestige. There is a lively debate that has gone on, particularly in recent years, about the extent to which Buddhism was really that oppressed or persecuted. And that's, I think, a valuable historical debate to have. I think it's been, to some extent, the degree to which the Korean Buddhist community had suffered outright persecution. If you compare it, for instance, to the way that the early Catholic community in Korea in the Joseon Dynasty was treated, it's obviously quite different. Catholics were rounded up and killed. Buddhists did not suffer that same fate. But despite that, there had been an effort on the part of the Joseon Dynasty leaders and scholar bureaucrats to really, how should I put it, to curtail the influence that Buddhism would have in society. And they did so by passing various laws to constrain the movement of Buddhists, to reduce the number of schools of Buddhism that were allowed to operate, reduced them down to just two major schools, the meditation school and the doctrinal school, where previously there had been a variety of different schools and sects of Buddhism. They tried to restrict who could become a monk or a nun. Eventually they mandated that Buddhist temples and monasteries in the major cities, the walled cities, be disestablished and moved outside to outside the city walls and generally to the temples. And the sense in which you at the end of the 19th century, you know, I talk about in the book about, you know, foreign travelers who came to Korea, Westerners who were surprised after having seen so many Buddhist temples in China, Japan, and the cities there, being unable to see them readily in Korea unless one traveled deep into the mountains. So this trope of a kind of mountain-centered Buddhism, that develops rather early on among reformers who are seeking to institute changes. That was a pejorative they used to try to signal how ensconced in their view and out of touch and literally out of the way Buddhism was in Korean society. They wanted a more active social role for Buddhism, many of these reformers. And so they kind of referred to Buddhism as really just a kind of a society outside society. It's a you know, unconcerned with the events of the day and simply pursuing their own enlightenment deep in the mountains. And that's, you know, again, I referred to this debate that has gone on about, you know, how accurate is that as far as an historical picture of Joseon Dynasty Buddhism? And I acknowledge that that's, I'm not trying to suggest that, you know, Buddhism was really cut off from society. There were important interactions that went on. I'm really in this book interested in this trope as a means, the perception more than the reality. And the perception was that the Buddhist community was cut off, was isolated, was backward, and that in order to have meaningful change, some movement would have to occur from coming from the mountains where they were positioned and moving into the cities, focusing on urban areas. And so that's where the title of the book comes from. It's actually a reference to a quote by probably the most famous reformer, who suggested that Buddhism really needed to become, you know, from the monks to all people, and from the mountains to the city streets. So that's where I took the title of the book from.
It's very interesting. And it seems like that dialogue, this critique, you can sort of see it in the dialogue about Mahayana Theravada paradigm of this sort of self-centered pursuit of enlightenment and the sort of selfless bodhisattva ideal. But I think we can talk a little bit about that when we get to Minjung Buddhism, which is much later in the history of the development. So you said a little bit about these reformers. Is there any one or two in particular that you could tell us about in detail? Like maybe Han Yong-un or,
Yeah, he's the one I was referring to. I said is the probably the most famous. He was a poet, and is also generally seen as kind of anti-Japanese, anti-colonial, nationalist Buddhist for his stance against the Japanese occupation. But he was very concerned with this very notion that Buddhists aren't propagating. The reason that Buddhism is not powerful, the reason that Buddhism has really subsided, and he said that the reason that Buddhism had lost power was because they had not propagated, that other religions were actively trying to spread their teachings, actively trying to recruit believers, and that Buddhism had shown no such concern, and that in order to change its fortunes, in order to become relevant, in order to survive, really, that changes were needed, and he saw propagation as one of the main pillars for accomplishing this feat. He wasn't alone in this. He was joined most of the well-known reformers also talked in their writings about the importance of Pogyo, of propagation, to effect change. Peg Yong-sung was another contemporary of Han Yong-un. Those two were signers of the Korean Declaration of Independence from Japanese rule in 1919. But others as well. All of them sort of diagnosed the problem of Korean Buddhism's isolation from society, its lack of relevance, the lack of interest among lay people, and its both its social isolation and its geographic isolation, and Pogyo appeared to offer a strategy for overcoming those obstacles.
I see. And so that kind of ties into what we plan to talk about next, which would be the temple ordinances that were instituted by Japanese colonial authorities. And those you write that those ordinances sort of delineated in legal writing what it meant to be a religion, and sort of defined in components, of which Pogyo was one. The activity and the space in which religion could exist in Japanese colonial Korea. Can you tell us a little bit about the temple ordinances and their effect on the propagation of Buddhism in the history of modern Korea?
Sure. Yeah. The law and legal aspects of this are, in my view, extremely important. Let's back up a little bit to the, before talking about the temple ordinance that the Japanese imposed shortly after formal annexation and the colonization of Korea, if we go back to 1895, which is a time when the Japanese are still active and influencing events, but are 15 years from formally annexing Korea. In 1895, there were, starting in 1894, these reforms instituted again at the sort of behest of the Japanese, by reformers installed by the Japanese in the court to, they're called the Kabo reforms. One of the proposals, which had not originated from the Japanese, but were made possible by this moment in which the Sino-Japanese War is going on and they're trying to force through a number of reforms. The centuries-old ban on monks and nuns from entering the capital and other major cities that I referenced earlier, it was lifted. The proposal was put forward, signed by the king. And what was interesting about that was, to me anyway, when I read some of the contemporaneous discussions of this and the rationale for doing so, Pogyo is listed as a reason. And one of the things it says is that, you know, in these times, the freedom of religion, the freedom to practice religion, the freedom to express one's religious beliefs, that already is being evidenced in as held up, I should say, as a kind of marker of a kind of modern nationhood, that government should, you know, respect this and adopt it. And so, you know, the reason for lifting that ban was that whereas foreign missionaries, both Christian missionaries from the West, as well as Buddhist missionaries from Japan, they had been allowed to establish missionary stations and temples in the cities, and that's where they were most active in trying to spread their own religions, while Korean Buddhist monks were not allowed by law to enter even. Let alone establish a space, a religious space from which they could then try to reach lay people. So the lifting of that ban in 1895 was interpreted by many of the observers of the time and as an important step in opening the door to this movement from the mountains to the cities and to allow the Korean Buddhist community to engage in this practice. If we fast forward to the Japanese takeover, their temple ordinance, which was designed to try to restrain and restrict the Buddhist community, to bring the Korean Buddhist community under the thumb of the Japanese authorities, they prescribed what were legitimate religious activities that could go on in temples. So this was a measure that was really meant to be repressive, but also to give the Japanese some authority over what goes on in temples. They also claimed to be protecting temple properties by making any selling of temple property had to be approved by the colonial authorities and things like that. They sold that as a way to sort of protect Buddhist properties and assets. But what I noticed was that not just in the temple ordinance, but also in the regulations and laws that the Japanese authorities instituted to deal with other religious communities, in their view, they included propagation as one of these legitimate religious activities that could go on. And they were very keen to try to promote this as a characteristic of what religions do. And so through that use of a sort of legal standard and a kind of normative shaping of what is considered under the law to be legitimate religious practice, propagation becomes a sort of a marker of, you know, what it is that the Buddhist community should be doing. And I argue in the book that this had an important influence. I don't think it was merely because the interest in trying to spread the religion predates the Temple Ordinance, which was instituted in 1911. But it does align. It shows the way in which a new definition of religion that was imported from the West and interpreted through the Japanese colonial authorities, this new definition of religion is placing priority on propagating, proselytizing as a legitimate function or practice within religious communities. So, you know, the effect of it is to say, if you're not propagating, then you're not really a religion.
And this also had an interesting impact on sort of the structure of how monasteries are run. And I think you can still see that reflected today. I know that some scholars point out it's historically sort of a characteristic of Japanese Buddhism to be very oriented around like a particular sect, such as Soto Shu or Nichiren Shu. And in your book, it sort of left me with the impression that these temple ordinances had that effect to a subtle extent on the structure of Korean Buddhism. Can you just talk a little bit about those laws and their influence in that regard?
Yeah, well, at the time in the colonial period, we did not Korean Buddhism, as I mentioned earlier, under the Joseon Dynasty, the number of schools, the independent institutionally recognized schools had been reduced. And the Korean Buddhist monastic community was treated really in a kind of a monolithic way. It's interesting that there were, even in the colonial period, things like Wan Buddhism that began, and were not accorded the same sort of, they were treated not as necessarily a part of the Korean monastic community, but even in that regard, they were emphasizing, they didn't use Pogyo, they adopted a slightly different term, but the effect was roughly the same. But institutionally, temples, as I said earlier, if one of the one of the activities that you are legally allowed to do is propagation, one would expect to see that the monastic community, as an area that is prescribed by law to be a legitimate religious activity, you know, it stands to reason that they would, right, engage in that, and it lined up with their own priorities, with many of the reformers' priorities for what to do. But the temple laws, which is slightly different than the temple ordinance. The temple ordinance was one law that covered all of the Korean monastic community. But then temple laws were supposed to be for each individual temple to adopt, even though they wound up using a kind of a template and all kind of adopting the same. But there were, you know, having a propagator on site and what kind of activities that person would do, how often did they go around, what kind of propagation did they do. All of these things find their way into the institutional rules and regulations by which the temples are run. So it really regularizes or institutionalizes Pogyo as a vital component of the life of the temples and monasteries.
Yeah. Before we go forward, I mean, I think this is all happening simultaneously. We have these threads throughout history of law and space, and we'll talk about media in regards to the history of Pogyo. But I think it's significant to stop and note out that this is also the beginning or reemergence of the urban space as a place, a reestablishment for the Korean Buddhist monastic community. Is that accurate? And can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah. So the Pogyo as a strategy of reform and as a kind of normative component of recognized Buddhist activity, also took on, became the vehicle by which the monastic community was able to move into the cities. So, as I mentioned earlier, the temples had been disestablished you could find them outside the walls of the capital, but not inside the capital. And so it's significant that the very first temple, the very first Buddhist space that gets constructed and built within the walls of the capital is in fact was called a Pogyodang, which is a propagation space. These Pogyodangs, these propagation spaces, constructed starting from after Kakwangsa, the one inside the capital, in increasing numbers throughout the colonial period, as a way for the mountain monasteries. They were usually set up as branch temples of a mountain monastery. And they enabled monks to have a physical space within the cities, from which to try to spread Buddhist teachings to the lay people who live there, to urban residents. And this kind of proliferation of propagation spaces is really what I mean when I talk about from the mountains to the cities. It was quite literally in a kind of a physical form, the manifestation of this idea of trying to engage socially in Korean society in ways that the religion hadn't previously done before. And it also served to help Buddhism compete against Christianity, but also against Japanese Buddhist schools who were establishing themselves in the peninsula. So it was a method for competing against rival religions. At the same time, they were also essentially copying what these other rival religious groups were doing in Korea by undertaking this propagation to begin with.
It's very fascinating. Well, at this point, it would be appropriate to say a little bit about Christianity in Korea in relation to the Korean Buddhist community, as well as what some of the Japanese Buddhist schools were doing at this time.
Yeah, I mean, Christianity in Korea has a fascinating history, mostly because it was established not through the presence of foreign missionaries, but rather from Koreans themselves who were reading imported books from China, things written by Matteo Ricci and other Jesuits who had lived in China and become conversant in the language, and they sought out Catholic priests in China to get baptized. And this is during the late Joseon dynasty and began, spreading Catholicism, without the presence of any foreign missionaries there doing it. And it's a very interesting genesis, no pun intended for Christianity in Korea. By the time we get to this period in the colonial period, Protestantism has obviously been established and is viewed very suspiciously by Japanese authorities, but they are a, a presence, even though their numbers, the number of converts, was rather low and would remain so for until we get to the late 20th century. Just their very presence, as elsewhere in Asia, to other Buddhist communities, it was both a kind of a stimulator, a motivator, but also a threat. And so the presence of Protestant churches who were aggressively proselytizing, evangelizing, you know, this is recognized by the Buddhist community as a significant threat. And if they did not react and formulate some strategy to counteract it, those reformers were quite concerned that Buddhism would essentially be overrun and crowded out by the spread of Christianity. And that remains a concern throughout the 20th century, even when Japanese Buddhism, which ostensibly was the model upon which Korean Buddhist reformers based their strategies for how to devise Pogyo, they still were cognizant of Christian, both Christian proselytizing methods, but also the threat that Christianity posed as it attracted more and more throughout the 20th century, more and more ordinary Koreans and encouraging them to convert and to self-identify as Christian.
And you mentioned throughout the book specifically about some of the mimetic processes that those behind Buddhist propagation may have adopted from Christian missionaries or modeled after Christian missionaries. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, I found it, you know, when I first became interested in this topic, which we discussed earlier, you know, I would ask a lot of folks that I knew in Korea about, you know, what they thought of Pogyo and what they, or, you know, reading some of the journal articles, newspaper articles in Buddhist publications about this, there seemed to me to be a kind of ambivalence about how much was taken from Christianity. I mean, it was almost like there was a recognition that, yeah, of course, Buddhism needs to try to spread its teachings, to reach people, to make the teachings accessible. You know, those are valid concerns. But there seemed to be I don't know exactly what the right word is for it, as a kind of a sheepishness then, or embarrassment over the fact that so much of it seemed to be copying what Christians had been doing. So to give an example, Peg Young Sung, one of the early adopters and reformers, early adopters of propagation, really a pioneer in trying to adapt Buddhism to ordinary lay people so that they could access it and share in its truths. You know, he did things like Sunday services, introducing Buddhist hymns into those services. You know, he was an adopter of some, for Buddhism anyway, really new innovative things, but many of them were really quite similar to what Christians were doing. And so I, for a long time, grappled with this, you know, how to deal with this, these mimetic processes. And I didn't see them as shameful. I just, to me, they looked like similar to things that always seem to go on in sort of syncretic environments and the way that religions always adopt and co-opt strategies that maybe their competitors are using. in order to in order to counteract them. And I found in looking through organizational theories a way to talk about this that legitimizes this as a strategy for change, right? So a survival strategy, just any organization, any company, this is a kind of, it's referred to as institutional isomorphism. Those organizations in similar fields tend to become more like each other over time because they negate the advantages that some company or organization may have by adopting it themselves. So to me, it looked like something very similar to what was being discussed by organizational theorists that was going on here. And so I talk a little bit about that, those theories and why I think they apply in this case.
Now, I'm just curious, this reorganization and this type of strategizing done by the Korean Buddhist community, based upon your knowledge, would you say that this could be observed of other Buddhist communities in different parts of the world? Maybe not explicitly Mahayana communities, but I'm wondering, as in terms of modern Buddhist studies, is this a trend that we could observe, to your knowledge?
I think so. I would say yes. I mean, we'll take the example of Japan, which is another Mahayana dominant country. I mean, much of the strategies that these Japanese Buddhist schools and sects were using in their overseas attempt to try to spread Buddhism overseas, this had been recognized as being copied from much of what Christians in Japan were doing. So the new Buddhism, the Shinbukyo, they were well aware of what Christians were doing and were trying to adopt and adapt various strategies to their own ends. I think we can see this really throughout Asia. It's evident in Sri Lanka. That's where the term Protestant Buddhism was first used to refer to what was happening in the late 19th, early 20th century in Sri Lanka. And I think it captures that same sense of certain amount of modeling and mimetic strategies in order to counter the threat that they posed. What's always been interesting to me is I feel like it's pretty widespread in Asian communities in late 19th, early 20th centuries. What seems unique about Korea to me is that these strategies, these methods, the focus on propagation, that continues. Whereas, say, for example, in Japan, it really doesn't seem to. I mean, after the end of World War II and Japan's defeat, there doesn't seem to be, maybe it's taken up by some of the new religions in Japan, this emphasis on kind of propagating, proselytizing, but not by the established schools and institutions. So my interest was why is Korea, why did propagation remain so important and so fundamental to the kind of organizational strategies and the reform methods? Why did it remain so vital in Korea? When in other Buddhist communities throughout Asia, there doesn't seem to be the same. It isn't sustained, in the same way. So that was a question that I considered for the book, and the later chapters go into this somewhat. And my answer to it is that I think it's because of the strength of the continued presence of Christianity and the growth of the Korean Christian community. Korea is really unique in having roughly equal sizes of Buddhist and Christian believers. You really don't find anywhere else that has that same kind of parity as we do in the religious demographics of Korea. And so that kind of continued competition and the continued threat that that Christianity posed to Buddhism, I feel, was an important factor in sustaining the emphasis on Pogyo as a method of reform.
I see. It's quite fascinating. Let's fast forward a little bit in time to post-colonial Japan. And you mentioned it's quite helpful that you use several different presidents as sort of markers in terms of law and geography and what is going on for Pogyo at that point in Korean Buddhist history. We start with Ree Singman, who interestingly is scholarship often notes either in passing or in strong emphasis the fact that he was a Christian. But can we talk a little bit about what was going on at the time of President Ree's, when President Ree was in office for Pogyo, and also particularly about the infighting regarding celibacy among the Korean monastic community?
Sure. Yeah. I'll just correct you. You had mistakenly said post-colonial Japan, but you obviously meant Korea. Well, before we talk about Syngman Rhee, we should mention the book deals only with South Korea after the end of liberation, right? So while it would have been nice to include something about North Korea, that's obviously a very different and difficult task. So really, I'm talking in the book about all of Korea until we get to that, right, the post-liberation, post-1945. But in South Korea, right after liberation, before the Republic of Korea is established, the Americans are in power, right? The American government, U.S. Army government in Korea, and they are setting policies that Syngman Rhee, I feel, was able to simply continue. Some of these are obviously pro-Christian. They are designed to advantage Christian communities over Buddhist communities. Many of the decisions that were made by General Hodge and the others who were in charge of the military government really put the Buddhist community at a disadvantage. So one of those, for example, was not repealing the Temple Ordinance, this very intrusive law that I had talked about earlier in the book as being kind of formative in establishing the environment, the atmosphere, and the legal incentives for groups to really focus on Pogyo. It also gives those in power considerable authority over what goes on inside temples and with the property and other things. So they didn't repeal the Temple Ordinance. They also did not return Japanese Buddhist properties to the Korean Buddhist community. They made Christmas a holiday and not Buddha's birthday. So when Syngman Rhee comes to power, he was backed, of course, by the Americans. He was a staunch anti-communist, which was really the main thing he had going for him, and the fact that he had been involved in the provisional government and other things. But he had authoritarian tendencies and was a devout Christian. It's really indisputable that he was favoring Christians and Christian community over Buddhists. in much the same way that the Americans had done when they were in charge. So, for instance, in the military, right, we get the Korean War in 1950. There are Christian chaplains, but there are no for Buddhists in the military. They have no spiritual advisors they can turn to. That was true in prisons as well. So there are a host of ways in which his pro-Christian inclinations, I think, work to the disadvantage of the Buddhist community. But you mentioned this infighting over celibacy, which was really sparked by, or I should say, inflamed by Syngman Rhee. So essentially, in the course of the colonial period, certain decisions had been made to allow monks to marry. This was a pretty predominant practice in Japanese Buddhism, right? There were Korean Buddhists who felt that, including Han Yong-un, who felt that celibacy is a relic of the past and should not be one of the requirements in order to be ordained. In the course of the colonial period, these restrictions against monk marriage were removed. And after the colonial period ended, after liberation, those who had held out, who had been adamant that celibacy as one of the precepts, right, according to the Vinaya and according to tradition within Korean Buddhist history, that this should be maintained and that the married monks should be tossed out. Unfortunately, the married monks were essentially in control of most of the temples. I mean, it had become the majority of monks were married and had families. And so the effort to try to remove married monks and to restore celibacy became, in the second half of the 20th century, one of the most important historical developments in Korean Buddhism. And Syngman Rhee charged married monks with being pro-Japanese. He sided with the celibates who were in the minority. He used government power to try to help out the celibates and to, through court cases and things, remove the married monks. What's generally the relation that this has to Pogyo and to propagation? Well, on the one hand, it consumed the infighting really sapped a lot of the energy and resources and other things that could have been used to propagate and could have been used to try to advance Buddhism and spread the teachings and do other things. But this what's known as the purification movement, that really got in the way. But what's not generally recognized is the fact that propagation served as one of the sort of core elements of the debate between these two sides. At least for the married monks, one of their arguments was, look, who is better to relate to lay people and to spread Buddhism in society than those who themselves have families and know what the difficulties that people face? You know, married monks are better equipped to spread Buddhism to the laity, teach them about it because they can relate to their everyday concerns. And so there was a proposal to try to, you know, create sort of two tiers. The married monks would be the propagators, while the celibate monks would be the kind of, you know, sort of hardcore meditators, the ones who, right, were in the meditation halls in the mountains and pursuing awakening. That didn't work as an argument for why married monks should be retained. I mean, the celibates said, you know, we'd love to have you contribute to spreading Buddhism and to this effort at Pogyo, but you're going to have to do it as a lay propagator, not as a monk. So that's interestingly, in today's what the Korean Buddhist community faces today, which is a lack of or the inability to attract enough young people to the monastic lifestyle because of the demands and celibacy certainly being one of them. It seems like this was an important turning point. Things could have really turned out quite differently in terms of Korean Buddhism if that situation had been handled in another way.
Quite fascinating. And I actually recall while I was in Korea, a monk kind of explaining the same rhetoric to me when I was considering becoming a monk. He told me, well, you can either go to a urban temple and help spread Buddhism, or you can take another path, which is to basically spend all your life practicing meditation, which we will talk about later in our interview. Okay. So if we fast forward, keeping in mind law as a thread and geography, if we fast forward a little bit to the presidency of Park Chung-hee and the Buddhist property management laws that were implemented under his presidency, what did that look like for Pogyo?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I did mention that the temple ordinance was not repealed, was not struck down by the Americans, and was not struck down by Syngman Rhee either. He kept it on the books, and it gave him tremendous power to interfere in internal Buddhist affairs like this celibacy argument. Certain portions of it were invalidated by Supreme Court cases that had found that things like getting government approval in order to sell property or things relating to the temple finances, those were invalidated. But in essence, the law remained there. Park Chung-hee, who came to power through a military coup d'etat, he's the one who actually replaced the temple ordinance with something that he called the Buddhist Property Management Law. For a lot of folks, this was not better than the temple ordinance. It was like the temple ordinance in a different name. What I found most interesting when I was researching this was that he kept, in essence, the same formula. He used Pogyo as one of these normative components of what Buddhists do, what Buddhist monks do, what Buddhist temples and organizations are intended to do. And that, again, reinforced the, from the sort of the legal side, the side of the state, that continued this, what I believe is a kind of a shaping of the, Buddhist community's efforts and where it placed its resources. So the Buddhist property management law was, gave the government gave Park Chung-hee considerable power over the Buddhist community, while also continuing this emphasis on Pogyo as a recognized legitimate area of religious activity that goes on in temples. But he also put an end to the infighting between the celibate and married factions. He forced the two sides to come together and to form a unified order, monastic order. But that was not sustainable, and eventually during his rule at the end of the 1960s and beginning of the 70s, that formal split occurred. So the Chogye Order, which is now the largest and dominant Buddhist order in Korea, became separate from what was called the Taegu Order. The married monks split off to form their own order. Both of them emphasized propagation as part of their sort of mission statements. Their organizational apparatus. They had even though the Choge Order had kind of neglected propagation and giving it the attention that many felt it deserved and needed. Nonetheless, the Buddhist property management law made it so that you could begin a new order. This is from this point on, we start getting more legally recognized schools of Buddhism and different orders, akin to sort of denominations in Christianity. But they all, many of them, started as these pogyo spaces, because they were generally founded in urban environments with new temples, because they couldn't have access to the traditional temples that were controlled by the Choge Order. And so they naturally took this form of propagation temples, and then later were, registered as such and such an order. So there's a continuing kind of entanglement of kind of law, of space, of Buddhist reform, that continues to play out throughout the late 20th century.
And as we talk about the late 20th century, at the end of the book, you mention this, I think it's from a scholar, religious studies scholar by the name of Tweed, this concept of crossing mm-hmm. over, highlighting the fact that it's important to remember that the monastic institution and the monastic community as a unit were not the sole source of Buddhist propagation. And in fact, as you just mentioned, many of these urban spaces in the late 20th century were sort of like private temples started by individuals such as Pomnyun Sinim, who you mentioned later. But I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about that at this point.
Sure. There was, and I know you'd wanted to talk about Minjung Bulgyu also, which is a kind of Buddhism of the masses. There has been, I think, a tension that has always existed between, not always existed, but there did exist this kind of tension between the institutional order, and the Chogyejung is the representative of that, and those who sought to reach the people, and that by that I mean the masses, ordinary people, and I would say from the 60s, 70s and into the 80s, it was really individual monks who were taking the lead on finding more innovative ways to try to adapt Buddhist teachings and practices to the demands of modern society and what people faced. And so, as you mentioned, Pomnyun Sinim, there are a number of what are today really kind of established lay-centered Buddhist organizations that were founded by usually charismatic monks who were committed to trying to spread Buddhism, were committed to this effort at propagation, and were kind of pushing the envelope or at least filling a vacuum that had been left by the Chogyejung, the Choge Order, and their preoccupation with other matters. So those were important steps. Eventually in the 90s, the Choge Order decided to devote more energy and more resources to this effort at reaching the laity, and of course still considerable amount of infighting. When I lived there in the 90s, there frequently on the news were clashes and battles between different factions of the Toge order, which didn't help as far as Buddhism's image in the country at a time when Christianity was really resurgent or surging, I guess I should say.
Yeah, so at this, we have Park Chung-hee's presidency, which is followed by Chun Doo-hwan's, who is highly, not that Park Chung-hee's presidency was not, but Chun Doo-hwan's presidency is characterized by a lot of authoritarian activities, to say the least. But in response to, and at the same time, there is economic and population growth occurring. And these are all influencing how Pogyo is occurring on the Korean Peninsula. And so in response to this, we have the Minjung Buddhist movement. Can you tell us about that? Because I think it's really important.
Yeah, so this is the origins of Minjung Buddhism. In some ways, they're seen in Korean Buddhist circles as going back to Han Yong-un and some of the early reformers who were, I mentioned earlier about the Han Yong-un saying, you know, Buddhism needs to become the Buddhism of all people, not just the Buddhism of monks and, you know, from the mountains to the cities. And, you know, the concern with reaching lay people and in particular to alleviate the suffering, to really put in practice the sort of bodhisattva ideals, right, of seeking enlightenment above but saving all beings below, right? And that's manifested. I mean, Pogyo, it can be hard to define, and some, I talk in the book about some of the definitions you find in Korean Buddhist propagation manuals that are, you know, for all intents and purposes, anything that happens where Buddhism is being taught is propagation. It can be a little bit sort of expansive, I think too expansive, but Minjung, the concerns of Minjung Buddhists, those who were advocating for a Buddhism of the masses, right, focused more on social problems, social ills, whether that's authoritarianism, right, the lack of democracy, or environmental concerns, or labor issues, or other things like that. That was lining up for those who were interested in engaging in propagation in Pogyo, meant that they were, by definition, interested in reaching the laity and reaching ordinary people. Well, it's not just about making scriptures available to these ordinary people so that they can read them in their lives, but also finding ways to help alleviate their suffering, not just on a spiritual plane, but also materially. And so many of the folks who were, you know, are recognized as sort of Minjung Buddhist activists either got their start by focusing on propagation or blended the two of those in innovative ways, and continuing to. I mean, Pomnyun is a perfect example of it. His organization, the Cheongtohe, is really done a lot to try to. It's the main concern is with social problems, right? As I said before, environmentalism or refugees or other kinds of things. But at the same time, he's also devising strategies for how to reach ordinary people, whether that advances the cause of Buddhism per se or not. It's really just about putting the principles of the religion into practice so that people will be, so that you can help alleviate their suffering.
Yes. We've taken quite a bit of your time, but there's two really critical points that we haven't talked about that I'd like to go over quickly before wrapping up, which is, one of them that you mention all throughout the book is media. Since from the very beginning of this emphasis on Pogyo, various types of media, such as newspapers, journals, and later on in the 20th century, broadcasting stations were utilized to implement Pogyo. Can you tell us the significance about that and some of the maybe really important examples of use of media in regards to Pogyo?
Sure. Yeah. It might be hard to do briefly, but I'll try. no, it's fine. Well, I do acknowledge in the introductory chapter that, you know, in my view, the written texts, I mean, it's more than a coincidence that Buddhism really started to spread outside India at the very moment when the Buddhist sutras and religious teachings are being committed to writing. I think that that's being able to transport the teachings in that form is vitally important to the spread of Buddhism, and texts have operated in an interesting way to as a focus of devotion, but also as a carrier of the Buddhist teachings. I mean, we know some of our oldest Buddhist manuscripts were discovered buried, right? They were placed in clay jars and buried underground. I mean, there seems to have always been this cognizance of the fact that the Buddhist teachings they're one day they're supposed to disappear, right? According to the Buddhist worldview, knowledge of the Dharma will eventually disappear, which, you know, that's going to bring Maitreya down and start the process all over again in some sense. But it is the form in which the Buddhist teachings are being disseminated has been important to Buddhist spread of Buddhism, I think, from the very beginning. Now, when it comes to the Korean Buddhist case in Pogyo, when a lot of the reformers talk about Pogyo, much of the activity that they engaged in was to produce new forms of Buddhist, new mediums to spread the teachings. And so Buddhist journals, magazines, and later newspapers, these become important. Buddhist publishing, Buddhist radio, the first effort in Korea to deliver a Dharma talk through that medium of radio goes back to the 1920s. It's really quite old. And in fact, Korea created the first Buddhist broadcasting station in the world. That's much later, and of course in the late 20th century. But it's continued right until today. And there's something that's known as cyber Pogyo. That is using the internet and using digital media forms in order to make available the Buddha's teachings and to spread them as widely as possible in society. So there's a very intimate connection between Pogyo propagation and media, because of course that's if you're spreading, disseminating, that has to take, you know, I mean, you can reach more people through the use of these other mediums than you can in just simply a face-to-face interaction.
It's quite interesting. You mentioned cyber Pogyo, and these days a lot of monasteries have their own YouTube channels in which the abbots and guest speakers regularly give Dharma talks and host other lectures on doctrine and things of that nature. It's quite fascinating. And one other form of Pogyo was in the urban space was the establishment of these sun practice centers, or as some of our listeners might know it, as chan, or even probably more popularly, zen. Can you tell us about the international sun centers and maybe just a little bit in general about the Korean style of zen practice for those of our listeners who may be practitioners and interested in that?
Yeah. So the International Sun Center, was founded by the, Choge Order, believe it was 2010. And it was meant, originally it was meant to be a kind of international temple stay, you know, a place for, foreigners in Korea to, experience Buddhism, to learn about Buddhism. We didn't really get to talk about the temple stay program, which I see as a sort of further extension or a new element to this, propagation effort. But the Sun Centers, the Choge Order in particular has, tried to kind of export Korean Buddhism. Now, in the book, I talk mostly about the efforts at sort of domestic propagation, right? Reaching the Korean audience, reaching a Korean audience and introducing them to Buddhism or furthering their understanding of it. I don't talk as much about the international effort, although there were some, and it goes back quite a ways. But the whole globalization that started in the 1990s, right? This effort to try to and the Korea wave as well, the exporting of Korean cultural products and things. It seems that the Choge Order has been keen to find a way to increase the exposure of Korean Buddhism to foreign audiences. The Sun Center, the International Sun Center, was a manifestation of that. And their belief, the leadership anyway, when they looked at the history of Korean Buddhism and its characteristics and what makes it unique, which is what they were really interested in, they settled on this form of meditation. It isn't technically speaking unique to Korea, although it's probably been emphasized. I mean, Buddhism in Korea, given the history of sort of constraining the forms of Buddhism that were available by the state, Sun Buddhism or Chan Zen became really the dominant form of Buddhism throughout the Chosun dynasty. So this is, you know, this is considered to be the sort of distinctive characteristic of Korean Buddhism, and they've sought ways to try to attract lay people, capitalizing in many ways on this interest in mindfulness and meditation, which we see more broadly, but they're continuing to try to find ways to reach people in ways they think will be beneficial to the lay people, but also beneficial to the monastic community and the institution, the order itself. And you know, the jury's still out on that one. We'll just have to wait and see. But that seems to have been the impetus behind that rather expensive effort. It's a beautiful building. I don't know if you ever visited, the International Sun Center in Seoul.
I have not, but I do recall visiting Songgwangsa and a monk telling me there that about the uniqueness of Korean Zen, and telling me about Kanhwa San and how he was giving me a sort of a lecture if you were to compare, say, Soto Zen in Japan to what occurs in Korea. But I think that's a topic for another interview.
Yeah, probably. I mean, so, you know, if you compared it to Rinzai, right, because that's essentially the tradition in Korea, it's different than Soto, of course, because that's a different tradition of Buddhism. But in any case, yeah, we'll leave that for another time.
Indeed. Well, I really appreciate all the time that you've given us. And before I ask you our traditional closing question, I'd just like to ask you if there's anything extremely critical that I might have overlooked that you'd like to share with us about your book.
No, I don't think so. I mean, Given the nature of the book and how much the time span it covers, and a lot of the sort of heterogeneous material that's in there, it's kind of hard to think, well, this was the glaring thing that we omitted in our discussion. But you know, I think people will hopefully get a sense of what the main argument is. I mean, I guess I'll just reiterate that, you know, in my view, this was a strategy meant to deal with changing circumstances and environments. And I cast it as a largely successful effort. I should say that I've gotten some pushback on that. It's been interesting to hear what particularly those in Korea think of the arguments. And I guess mostly they seem to think I paint too much of a rosy picture of this. You know, part of that is because, you know, the census in 2015 showed Buddhism losing some ground, right, with the number of Christians, the number, particularly Protestants, increasing somewhat, and those who claim to an identity as Buddhist declining. That would seem to be a repudiation of these efforts, right? That it's not really working, and so, you know, how can I really talk about it as a success? Of course, I'm not simply talking about numbers of you know, self-described, self-identified Buddhists. Really, I think this was well suited to the challenges that the Buddhist community faced, given its geographic location, given its the history that it was dealing with, demographic changes in society, technological changes, and just the demographics, right? Of increasingly, I mean, Korea went from being predominantly rural to overwhelmingly urban. At least South Korea did. So without this emphasis on trying to establish places within cities and methods for how to reach people who are there, I think, you know, the Buddhism would have struggled more so than it perhaps did to find relevance in Korean society and establish a viable place going forward. That just simply wasn't a guarantee at the start of the 20th century that Buddhism would continue to have a place in Korean society. I guess that's, yeah, if I can just sort of reiterate what I think is the importance of this, and the fact that, you know, most books choose an individual or maybe text or set of texts or a group of people, or an institution or an event. This is really a study of a strategy. And so it's a bit different, than others maybe that people would have encountered.
Yes, and it's quite fascinating. I would encourage all of our listeners who are interested in any of the topics that we've discussed today, so geography, law, and their intersection, to check out the book, purchase it, and encourage your university library to purchase it. But get your hands on it, because we've just scratched the surface of the detail of Dr. Nathan's scholarship. So before we close, we usually end an interview by asking you what we can expect from you in the future. Are there any publications and journals or books that you have in the works? What are your interests, research interests at this point in time?
Well, there have been, one caveat is the way that this, what we're going through now in the pandemic has influenced a lot of those. I mean, one of the areas that I've continued to pursue and has been important to me in my scholarship is continuing to look at this relationship between law and Buddhism. You know, I had co-edited really the first volume of its kind dedicated to study of law and Buddhism. And we started a journal here at the University at Buffalo, Law, Buddhism, and Society Journal, which I'm on the editorial board for. And so I've remained active in that. I was supposed to attend a conference or workshop last month, actually, in Chicago at the American Bar Association to look at Buddhism and constitutionalism. So I'm working on a piece that looks at the the issue we talked a little bit about, the celibacy. I'm really quite interested in how that fight, that conflict between the celibate side and the or non-married and married monks, how that played out. Much of it was took place in the courts, so I'm working on a piece that investigates that from a legal perspective, from a judicial perspective. Let's see what else. I've also been working on the Peg Young Sung that I mentioned has been an interesting figure for me. I have a long-standing project that seems never-ending to translate one of his works. But also there's a volume coming out about modern Korean Buddhism, I think co-edited by Hwansoo Kim and Jinyoung Park, that I have a piece in there talking about Peg Young Sung and just sort of research methodology of looking at micro versus macro history. I can't say yet what the next monograph exactly is going to be because I haven't yet proposed it, but stay tuned. I'll say that.
Okay. Well, I look forward to seeing all of your future works, and I hope our readers will check them out as well. You do a really excellent job of taking lenses that are not typically utilized in the field, such as law and geography, and applying them to the field, which provides for quite interesting reading, as our listeners will find out. So thank you for your time today, and thank you for our listeners. We hope to have you again in the future.